Welcome to Movie Moments, discussing the greatest movies of all time. Plus, all the newest films in theaters and streaming. Like us, rate us, share us. Here are your hosts, Mike Rags and Chuck Curry.
Hey, we're back for another edition of Movie Moments. I'm Mike Rags with Chuck Curry, talking about the greatest movies of all time. Special guest on the show today coming up. Chuck got a chance to sit down with Peter Facinelli, and he's got a brand new movie coming out actually this weekend called On Fire, kind of a disaster film. So Chuck sits down with Peter, and very special guest on Movie Moments later on in the show. And in honor of that, we'll talk about some of the greatest firefighting movies and fire in movies of all time. Before we get to Peter, that's later on in the show. Of course, follow us, subscribe wherever you are, Spotify, Apple, wherever you listen to the show. Make sure you are subscribing to us and telling all your friends about it. Let's bring him in right now. Chuck Curry. Chuck, the final weekend in September, and a lot of movies coming out today, Chuck. So it'll be interesting to hear what you have to say as far as the box office, where it's heading, what it's doing. You have Saw out there. You got a kids movie and Paw Patrol. Saw versus Paw. What are you hearing on the movie front right now?
Actually, Paw Patrol's tracking pretty well. I think it's going to double the original film, which went day to day, meaning it was released theatrically and also on streaming same day. I think this one's tracking around a $23, $24 million opening weekend. Saw 10, which brings back Tobin Bell, who's now 81 years old, as Jigsaw, actually getting the best reviews, Mike, in the franchise history. Wow. Believe it or not, as well as some of these Saw movies have done. It is a really interesting franchise. I'm a big fan of the original film. I like some of the sequels. It's not a franchise at this stage in the game in my life that I'm going to run out to a movie theater and see it. Having said that, this is going to open at around 17, 18 million. Maybe if it gets some wind behind its sails, it will hit 20. But
What about the big release, The Creator, that comes out this weekend too?
That's tracking. Here's the deal. Garrett Edwards did that movie. He's the guy who did the Godzilla reboot. He did Rogue One. Yeah. Correct. Mm-hmm. Rogue One. He's a good director. The people who like this movie really, really dig it. It was produced for around 80 million. A lot of people in the industry in the know say it looks like a $200 million movie plus. So visually, he did a great job on an $80 million. Now, an $80 million budget to us sounds like a lot of money, but standard studio fare, $80 million is a solid but not stupendous budget. I think it's tracking like 14, 15 million. So it's not going to get out of the gate the way the studio. I believe it's being released by Disney, but Denzel Washington's son is the star of this film, which is getting mostly good reviews, a couple naysayers, but overall good reviews. A lot of stuff enters the marketplace. You got next week, as we spoke last week, we sort of did a preview, Exorcist Believer. And then the week after, you got the Taylor Swift, who's been in the news this week again. Her concert film tracking at over $125 million opening weekend. Now, this past weekend, Expendables 4 pretty much bombed, just did $8 million in business, $100 million budget. I guess overseas will probably perform a little bit better, but probably, as we said, an ill-advised project that will probably be a financial loss for its producers and backers.
All right. Well, that's what's the box office is going to look like so far this weekend. And of course,
I did get a chance, if you don't mind, I got a chance to see Equalizer 3.
Yeah. I got a chance to see the movie too. So go ahead. You go first.
I'm definitely a fan of the Equalizer franchise. I love Denzel Washington in this role of Robin McCall, guy who equalizes some hairy situations for regular people. I went by myself, Mike. I took a ride. It was last Saturday. It was raining. I said, let me go to the movies. This was a great company movie. I absolutely loved watching Denzel do his thing in this movie. I thought the setting, which his third installment takes place in Italy, I thought it was a great setting. I wasn't sure if it would work when I was going into production. I was like, why are they taking this concept, bringing it to Italy? but he deals with low-level mafia. It is a slow burn movie for the first half of its running time. And that's what makes it so effective, because one, they do very nuance on his character, on the citizens in this small town. You get to know, there's an Italian actress who plays a semi love interest to Denzel. Now, there were scenes that they shot that they wound up cutting out of the film because from what I read, Antoine Fuqua, the director, said test audiences didn't like the fact that he was involved with another woman, because I think in the first film, his wife had passed and he was very reminiscent of that fact in his life. But there is a subtle connection between this actress and him. She's 38 years old in real life. I think he's 68, but it's very beautifully done. And the other characters in this movie, the guy who takes it in, I'm not going to tell you why, you'll have to see the film, but very good character. There's a local a law enforcement character, very good. You connect and bond with all these characters. And then halfway through, the villainous mafia starts to take hold. And you wound up, Mike, you wind up hating these people so much that there's a scene in this movie almost at the third act, in the beginning of the third act, when Denzel's Robert McCall meets up with this guy in a local restaurant. And it's the dialogue. It's so cathartic. And I like the first two a lot, but I think this one's the best installment in the franchise. I give it an 8 out of 10. It was very satisfying just on hanging out with this character for almost 2 hours. The revenge aspects of it, the cinematography was beautifully shot, the setting. I liked all the characters, and I love Denzel. He's awesome in this movie. So if you like this type of a genre and you want to see something that's not a guy flying around in a cape, I highly recommend it. I had a really good time. I would border on saying I love this movie. I really did like it a lot. Yeah, I liked it a lot. Yes.
I mean, and in other words, 15 years ago, it probably would have made a ton of money in the movie theaters and would have been a must-see for Denzel Washington.
They shot it. The production cost was $75 million. It's right around $150 million worldwide. So it's going to be profitable going on to its secondary market, which would be streaming and Blu-ray. And that's all any financial backer could ask for. So I'd like to see a fourth one. I really would. I know they say this is it. We'll see. But Denzel's one of those rare actors that
he rarely makes a bad movie. I mean, let's face it. If he's in it, it's going to be pretty good. I mean, the only movie
this one more than the others reminded when I was watching it. It felt like when I was sitting in a movie theater watching Pale Rider back in the 80s, like that aura of the Shane type storyline where this mysterious character is there to save these, innocent people. It just had that feel to it. I really did dig it.
He will actually make any movie 2.5 stars. It's just a question of if it's going to get better than that. I mean, the only movie I think I hated him in was Virtuosity, which was him and Russell Crowe. I thought that was trash. But that was a while ago. He's usually pretty good. John Q, I thought was contrived, but I know you liked it. He's just awesome.
Yeah, it is contrived. It's interesting to bring that up because I watched that. I remember watching it about 4 months ago. It is definitely contrived. But listen, Denzel's so good that
he's in it. Like I said,
he supersedes all the flaws.
Even the flaws of The Siege. I mean, he's still really good in it. And it has a lot of problems. So, I saw a great documentary, and I mean great documentary on Netflix about the life of Mike Vec and his dad, Bill Vec, the owner of the Chicago White Sox. It's called The Saint of Second Chances, and it's told via Mike Vec, and it's actually narrated by Jeff Daniels. And Charlie Day, actually, from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, pops up and acts as Mike Vec during the movie. I mean, it is just a second chance kind of flick that gives hope to anybody that's ever failed at a job and has to come around. Of course, Bill Vec was an eccentric owner of the Chicago White Sox back in the day, and Mike was the one that organized the disco night, Death to Disco night at the White Sox, that ended up basically turning into a riot and fire.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was failed.
Let me ask you a question. Whose idea? I remember, because I'm reflecting now, whose idea was it to have the Chicago White Sox wear shorts.
That was him. That was Bill Veeck. That was his dad. Yeah. His dad, they wore shorts. That's part of the show too. But it's really a redemption story about how Mike Veeck has to basically go in hiding for a while, but his love for baseball brought him back to the minor leagues. Daryl Strawberry pops up in it as well because he's on the St. Paul team that Mike Veeck takes over, and he gets redemption too because that's where he rehabbed and got back to the Yankees. So it's a real good story, and it turns out to be a little bit of a tearjerker as well towards the end. And Mike Veeck, what an eccentric, great character, and a real-life character. Check it out. It's called
The
Saint.
How old was he when he ran the White Sox? How old?
His dad was pretty old. His dad was in his probably in his 80s, but he was the owner's son helping organize things. And it was his bright idea to bring in a local DJ from Chicago and blow up some disco records. And that day lives in infamy. And he basically could have ruined his life, but it didn't. And this movie shows how it doesn't. Real good flick. Saint of Second Chances. It's on Netflix right now. Cool. Check it out. Especially if you love baseball, too, and minor league baseball, because it's got some real good stuff. Chuck, before we get into movie news, we did have someone pass away this past week. It gives you a chance to talk about toys for 5 seconds, I'm sure. But Michael Gammon died. Long life, a great career, 82 years old. Obviously, he was Harry Potter's. He took over the Richard Harris role when he passed away.
He did a great job.
He did a great job there. But Michael Gambon, Dumbledore, passed away. So here's your chance. He was the villain in Toys. So if you want to bring up Toys, go ahead.
Well, it's almost Christmas, so why not? this is all I'll say about Toys. Toys is an acquired taste, maybe the most eccentric of all Robin Williams' performances, and that's saying a lot. Listen, I enjoy it on a certain level. I can't defend it from a critical point of view, but at Christmas time, I could watch it, and I'll get a kick out of it.
All right, so I wanted to bring that up for you.
Thank you very much, by the way. I appreciate it.
What movie news? And remember, we've got Peter Fascinelli joining the show later on on the podcast. Of course, great actor and director. Now he's in the Twilight series. Was in Can't Hardly Wait, one of my favorite teenage movies of the I think it was late 90s, early 2000s. What movie news do you have for us today?
I got a bunch of this week in TV history. But before I get to that, in terms of movie news, now that the writer's strike is over, a lot of these projects that were in sort of limbo for the last 5 months could now actively start to get going. One of them is going to be the scripting on Matt Reeves' The Batman 2 in production. I think Gladiator 2 was halfway through production. That could any rewrites on that film can go this Monday. There's going to be a sit down meeting between the studios and the actors. Hopefully that'll end this thing. I guess there's been a lot of banter. I've been watching a lot of videos on YouTube about actually who got what in terms of the writer's strike. This is what I think. I think the writers who are successful, they've certainly gained because the people who are good are going to get more. But like to say that every writer is going to get something out of this would probably be an understatement, because the bottom line at the end of the day, the writers obviously have to be hired. They have to deliver. And the ones who deliver, obviously, they get job after job after job. That's why you see a lot of the same writers on a lot of different credits, because it is a rare craft. It's a unique craft. Not everybody could do it to the level that needs to be done. But hopefully the industry could get its footing back now that the writers are back. They could start moving these projects forward, have a lot of, it's a perennial bullet in the gun, get the actors back, start a lot of the stuff in the pipeline. But I did see one interesting observation, Mike, which I tend to agree. I think we're going to see a very different Hollywood in terms of, I think they've learned a lesson by the overspending on streaming. So I think going forward, even though you're going to see an initial pop in a lot of things moving forward, I do think the industry as a whole will streamline, and I think they're going to be more selective on what they greenlight, put into production. And I think the streaming model overall going forward, say 5 years out, I think will be streamlined. I wouldn't be surprised if some of them morph two into one. I think I wouldn't be surprised if some of the studios drop their streaming and just outsource their product to another more substantial streamer. But I don't think the industry is going to stay the way it was. It will change in many different directions.
And you get to talk to Peter Facinelli about it a little bit later on the show too. Yes. So it's interesting. All right, what do you got this day in TV? I know it's called movie moments, but Chuck likes TV, so we'll let play. We'll let him play around.
Well, maybe we should change the title. But September 25th, 1997, NBC airs a live episode of ER. I remember watching that. This has been done with sitcoms. I know the Conners did it a few years ago. It's been done on other sitcoms going live. But think about how hard that had to be to do a drama like ER, where they use multiple cameras in multiple sets, all in the same setting. And it went pretty flawless. September 25th, 1997. September 26, 1962, we weren't born, but Beverly Hillbillies premieres on CBS. Any recollection of that show?
No, I hate
that
show.
Okay, here's one that we both, I think, love. And I got a story on this one. September 26, 1964, Gilligan's Island premieres on CBS. Bob Denver, Alan Hale Jr., Jim Backus. The first few episodes I know were shot in black and white. I'll tell you a quick story. When I was a kid in school, elementary school, when we had auditorium, they made an announcement that we were going to watch a TV show. And somebody comes into the auditorium with 3 35-millimeter reels, and they screen an episode of Gilligan's Island for us. Think about this. A projector, a movie projector in 3 35-millimeter reels to show a 20-minute non-commercial episode of Gilligan's Island. But I got to tell you, Mike, I have a ton of memories watching the show as a kid. The TV movies, when they tried to get off the island, I was always on pins and needles on the edge of my, where are they going to get off the island? Oh, my God, it fell through again. But Bob Denver was awesome on that show, and it was a simple premise.
Yep.
Like one or two sets, and it worked.
Well, just like every great sitcom, it's character driven, and it's all based on you care about from the Professor Marion, all of them. You cared about every single one of them made you laugh in a certain way, and that's what was great about that show.
I agree. Now, a year later, 5 years later, September 26, 1969, The Brady Bunch premieres on ABC. I'm going to tell you a footnote that I researched and read that you're going to fall over. Robert Reed got the role of Mike Brady, right? Mm-hmm. Originally, the producers wanted Gene Hackman, the star. Now, think about that. Think if Gene Hackman got that role. What would he have done? The French Connection, The Poseidon Adventure, Lex Luthor, and Sue? Probably not, right?
No.
I mean, his career probably would have morphed down a completely different road. So sometimes
he'd be more Bill Bixby than Gene Hackman probably down the road, his career.
I mean, so again, the saying, sometimes the decisions you don't make are the best decisions you ever made, right?
But probably the best decision of Robert Reed's career too, though, because that really solidified him as a bona fide TV star. He'd go opposite his character on TV and do Roots. And, unfortunately he didn't live a very long life, but definitely a mainstay in TV and a great casting there. He was perfect as the dad. And of course, Florence Henderson as well.
And think about this. I mean, the long run, the show, I think it ran for 9 years, but like then it morphed into a
variety show. Yeah.
And then they did reboots of it.
Yep.
And
remember that Christmas one was a huge TV movie that big ratings when they rebooted it way back in I think that was the late 80s and early 90s. And a lot of people watched the Christmas episode.
I got one.
Had another series too. They tried to do it as a hour long drama series later on as well. So it wouldn't go away. I guess the kids needed.
It wouldn't go away.
Yeah, they needed them. Look, their mortgages due just like everybody else.
The two movies were good. The movies were really good. Betty Thomas did were really good.
And iconic episodes
too.
Yeah, it's part of my childhood, no doubt about it. What I want to know is, look, I know there's six kids. But Florence Henderson, Carol didn't work. Why the heck did they need a maid? I mean, I don't know. Isn't that a little overkill? I mean, this Mike's got to pay for a maid, too. I mean, come on. You're home all day. You could take care of it. I don't know. That's just me. Maybe I'm old-fashioned that way. I thought that maybe they didn't need a maid in that house, but that's just me. Without the maid, though, we wouldn't have got the butcher. We wouldn't have known Sam, right? So I guess it all played a part.
Well, I got one more before we go into veer into a different topic. September 26, 1985. we talked about this a little bit about jumping the shark, the infamous jump the shark in a right way episode of Dallas aired. Bobby Ewing, played by Patrick Duffy, appears at the end of the episode in a shower, seen by his wife, Pam, played by Victoria Principal.
Victoria Principal, yeah.
Eradicating the whole season as a dream and rebooting a show going forward. An insane idea, but a necessary one. It had to be done because it showed the importance of how important Patrick Duffy's Bobby was in that Dallas universe, going up against his brother JR, played brilliantly by Larry Hagman. We jumped the shark. This was a good idea to jump the shark here, though.
Well, not only that, but not too many TV producers will listen to the fans, and the outrage from the fans in that offseason was so large that they just figured we might lose a huge fan base here if we don't make a dramatic move. And that was probably a wise decision, and it but allowed that show to go service. On. What's that?
You believe in fan service.
I
do.
To that extent, very much so, yeah.
I mean, I hate when the fans really want, like, we talked about this about J.D. Abrams' Star Wars, the first one, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How many people, I mean, we both like that film a lot. I like it a lot, but how many people wanted to see Luke, Han, and Leia all in the same scene? We never got it, right?
Right. Right.
And the question is, it's so obvious, like the nose on your face, right? But we didn't get it. And the question is, like, why?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
but again, I'm often one of those guys too. Like the movie for what it is, but not what you wanted it to be. You know,
I agree. I liked it a lot. We are on record to say we did like it a lot. One more I got. This brings back a memory. September 30th. I didn't watch it. I wasn't born yet, but I did watch it in repeats. Very fond. 1960, the Flintstones animated premieres on ABC. I'll tell you a story again. When I was a kid.
Prime time, by the way. Prime time.
Yes. Show. Yeah. And the Honeymooners aired in 1955. This basically was a homage to the Honeymooners. And I think it's one of the best animated cartoons of all time.
No doubt about it. Last week, I think it was the anniversary of the Jetsons, too. So I used to watch those two shows all the time, back to back, growing up.
I'll tell you a quick story. When I was a kid, before my mother sent me to school and I walked to school, I grew up in an apartment house in Brooklyn, New York, and it was always a little cold in the morning. So I used to sit on the radiator, right? And I watched two cartoons before I went to school. 8 o'clock in the morning, I think on WPRX or Fox 5, the Flintstones, and then Magilla Gorilla when I was a little boy. And I love those two. But I love the Flintstones. It was ahead of its time. It was so well done. It just worked. It totally worked.
And of course, since it aired in primetime, it had to have a laugh track too, which is always kind of funny too. Like there's an actual studio audience watching. But that's funny stuff. Is that it? We got through TV. And because basically it's September and October, you could probably go through every year and a great TV show probably debuted around this time.
No doubt.
Before we go any further, let's go back into the theaters. Pick a year from our from the 80s and 90s here, Chuck, and I'll tell you what came out and you tell me what you would have seen.
80s or 90s?
Yeah.
We'll go with
1988, the weekend of September 30th, October the 2nd. Here's what's new in theaters. Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. Remember how popular she was back in the day. Heartbreak Hotel comes out as well, which was David Keith, right? Playing Elvis Presley with a bunch of teenagers in a car. Punchline with Tom Hanks and Sally Field debuted as well.
Interesting movie. That was a very interesting. You could argue that movie was somewhat flat, but there were people who did like it, and it dwelled on the subject of stand-up comedy, which has not really been explored a lot in feature films. So it was a good subject matter.
So those are your new movies. I think we'd venture to say Punchline is probably the one we'd go see coming out in theaters. But there was a couple of movies in the top in the theaters that you might have gone seen as well. Gorillas in the Mist, A Fish Called Wanda, Dead Ringers, and Die Hard was still running strong as well.
All good.
And Cocktail and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So lots of chances to go to the theaters. Now, If you're going back in time now, all those movies are out. I know you're going to say Die Hard, but what would you watch? And would it probably have been the 15th time you've seen it by then?
I actually saw it 10 times in a theater. So that would have been my 11th if I went back.
It was the 12th week of its release.
It's incredible the legs those movies had. I mean, think about it. I remember Die Hard. Die Hard never opened big. Die Hard had, if my memory is good, and I know it's good, I think it opened $7 million.
It churned and burned is what it did.
It was doing like $5 million a week. It never dropped. Just kept chugging and chugging and chugging and chugging.
Another one, too, was A Fish Called Wanda, right? That was a summer movie. That was out 12 weeks already, and it was the third most popular movie of the week. I mean, 51 million at the time, one of the funniest movies of the 80s, and that was a movie, too. All British actors and Jamie Lee Curtis and Kevin Kline, but it got such good word of mouth. It was so entertaining and funny.
And a major player at the Oscars.
Major player at the Oscars, and it just kept building. The popularity of it kept building. That's why you see those movies that basically came out the same weekend in the summer, still in the top five in theaters back in 1988. So good year. If you need a good laugh, you're going to see A Fish Called Wanda. And if you needed a action movie, of course, it was Die Hard. All right, Chuck, let's talk about fire in film. And obviously, we're going to delve into the disaster genre here a little bit with fire. I didn't see Hellfighters with John Wayne, which is really the first firefighter movie that I can think of back in the 1960s. But, you and I were both fans of the TV series Emergency One. Great show that combined both the medical drama and the firefighting drama back in the early 70s. But really the granddaddy of it all and where it all starts is The Towering Inferno in 1974. Obviously, we are not shy talking about how much affinity we have for this movie, one of the greatest movies of all time, one of the greatest disaster movies of all time.
I agree, and
I know I talk to firefighters even to this day. They still reference not only the power of the movie, but the accuracy of the movie. And it's almost 50 years old now. What more can we add about The Towering Inferno?
I just think, if anybody ever got a chance in this generation who may not know of The Towering Inferno and clearly never saw it in a movie theater, if you ever get a chance to see it in a movie theater, I still think it's one of the most epic movies ever made. It's so well done. Some of the best, maybe the best star power pairing of all time in Paul Newman and Steve McQueen. I think the effects, they use miniatures. I mean, when I say miniature, I don't mean the size of our hand, but the building itself was, a few stories tall. And the effects hold up, I think, beautifully. It's a terrific film. I remember as a kid when I opened the newspaper to see, the ads in the newspaper, just to see like the different artwork they did on that movie. It always excited me. I mean, I love looking at old newspaper clippings. And, when I see the Poseidon Adventure of the Towering Inferno, I get goosebumps. It was a big part of my childhood, that disaster genre. But Towering Inferno is a 10 out of 10 movie.
I am looking at the movie poster art in my den right now as we do this podcast.
It's awesome.
One of my favorite movie posters. And one of my favorite movies, and Chief O'Halloran with Steve McQueen, one of my favorite characters on screen of all time. And I still watch the scene when they tell him the bad news where he's got to go up and blow the fuses. I just love that scene.
And
he's got
the
great line.
The audience had to that scene.
Yeah, great line. Yeah. Now, you had a couple disaster movies right after that, City on Fire and Fire. Fire was a TV movie with Ernest Borgnine, Patty Duke, Vera Miles. And
as
City on Fire
was
Barry Newman.
As you could see in those movies, they always casted young.
They went for the young audiences, right?
That's the difference in the genre. If you were under 40, you weren't getting a role, right?
Right, right. City on Fire, to me, out of the two, is probably the better film. But I say that
theatrically. I remember enjoying Fire as a TV movie. City on Fire, I actually watched it a few months ago. It was on YouTube.
It's
ridiculous.
It's fun to see Leslie Nielsen and Barry Newman and all the stars.
I love Barry Newman, the late Barry Newman now. But he was awesome.
I remember watching a show called Code Red on TV, Lauren Green series that probably only lasted a couple of maybe a season and a half. Remember, Adam Rich was on that show too, hot off of Eight Is Enough. We move into the 80s. Not a lot of firefighting movies in between, but Turk 182 comes out in 1985, which was a bomb. Timothy Hutton trying to get insurance money for his brother, Robert Urich, of all people, who got hurt in a firefighter. I remember Siskel and Ebert just lambasting this movie. It's not as bad as people might remember, but it didn't make any mark at the box office. Any memories of Turk 182? Take place in New York City, by the way.
I do. I know I saw it in the theater, and I know the main criticism is that I think the storyline sort of jumps the shark from the get go.
Yeah,
like it shoehorns where it wants to go, and you feel it. It's an implausible movie with some good acting talent.
A couple of movies that have firefighting around it, not really about fire, but I enjoyed both of them. Roxanne with Steve Martin, a lovable Cyrano de Bergerac firefighter, a very lovable movie there. And The January Man comes out in 1989, which he plays a firefighter, turns in, he was a former cop, almost an implausible movie, but fun because Kevin Kline, I think that was his first film after A Fish Called Wanda winning an Oscar. And then Always comes out in 1989. Of course, this is a Steven Spielberg film that not many people have probably seen, with Richard Dreyfuss and John Goodman as forest firefighters. Dreyfuss dies and he kind of haunts Holly Hunter. It was a remake of an old 50s film. Spielberg got panned a little bit here for this film, Chuck. Very visually stunning and great, but a very, very weak storyline.
Yeah, I just watched in my journey to watch every Siskel and Ebert show on YouTube, I just watched him review this movie in my parallel universe mind, my multiverse mind. And yeah, they gave it a strong thumbs down. They just thought it was flat and pretty uninspired, which is surprising from Spielberg because it was a pet project. He wanted to do it for many a year.
Yep. And one of my favorite movies of the 90s. Now, I know firefighters get a little offended by this film because the bad guy is a firefighter in Backdraft, but I absolutely adore this film. It's so well done. Ron Howard, the director, Kurt Russell as the lead. And of course, the special effects are so good in it. They made a special category for it that they won. And they made a special ride for it at Universal as well. Backdraft is a powerful movie, Chuck, with a great score by Hans Zimmer. Look, it's flawed. And it probably was a big mistake to make the main villain a firefighter, but all-star cast, great performances, and just the best performances by the fire. It's a real good watch.
Well, Jennifer Jason Leigh of Fast Times at Ridgemont High fame took a lot of heat because her performance was weak in this movie. The positives, though, and I like this movie a lot, Billy Baldwin, I thought was the best thing he's ever done, in my opinion.
Probably.
Like,
that's,
I mean, he
that's
really
not saying
was
much, but yes,
film.
I agree.
He was the best thing he's ever done. The Kurt Russell death scene at the end is awesome, right?
Yeah, it is.
I mean,
it's
really awesome, powerful. The Donald Sutherland character is sort of a ripoff of Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. And
yeah.
God.
And he would reprise the role in Backdraft too.
Oh, I remember you telling me to see that. I was like, this is before really streaming.
Yeah. Took off. Yeah.
Gained hole. Right. Took off. And they were doing these, whoever was producing this stuff saying, let's just take a name title. How Universal gave them the title to do Backdraft 2 of that. I mean, it's just unwatchable garbage. It's just terrible.
It is bad.
I mean, terrible. I mean, it's like talk about the bottom of the Walmart bin. Like, my hand couldn't reach it so bad. But I will say this. I do think it was ill-advised to make a firefighter. I can't believe that they allowed that. It was dumb. Having said that, it's still a very good movie. The fire scenes are excellent. And Ron Howard does a good job as a director. And it was a big hit. So, we're both big fans.
And 1997, not a lot of firefighters, but plenty of fire with two volcanoes erupting. I think you're more partial to Dante's Peak. Volcano came out as well. They're both very watchable films. But
I've been watching Volcano. I bought it on Prime. I watch it in my shop at least once a month because it's a good visual. I'm going to really like it. I think Anne Heche and Tommy Lee Jones have a solid, respectable chemistry in this film. I like both of them. I mean, again, in Dante's Peak, what I like about that film is I think the chemistry, again, a respectful adult chemistry between Pierce Brosnan and Linda Hamilton is very good. I like both those films.
Yeah, both of them are very effective films. With that was the peak of the resurgence of the disaster movies as well. Chuck, there was a movie called Trapped on the what the heck's it? It was a Lee Majors TV movie that a lot of people give buzz to. I never saw it, but it came out in 1988 as well. I wanted to bring it up because it's on a
was that John Forsythe?
I maybe he was. I can't remember if he was in that or not, but I only bring it up because
it was it Trapped on the 40th floor,
the 23rd floor, or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I never saw it, so I'll bring it up.
I know there's one with John Forsythe. I think it's called Trapped on one of those floors that did get really good reviews. I actually, it is. I think it's on YouTube. I tried watching it, but the print is awful. Like the YouTube print, because it's, you know, it's framed at 4:3. It is actually hard visually to watch it. But if it's the movie you're talking about, I think it was actually pretty good.
All right. Well, I'll take your word for it because I never saw it. And in doing the research for the show today, there was just a lot of it popped up a lot on lists that I had never seen. So I wanted to give it its due, per se, Chuck. So we got through both disaster movies and the volcanoes. What about wasn't there a also a firefighter in the woods with the guy that's on Fox Sports football, Howie Long? Didn't he do one as well? What was the name of that movie?
He played was it firefighter. Called Firestorm?
Firestorm, yeah, right, yeah.
Okay, thoughts on Firestorm. Let me tell you a story about that movie. The movie was a misfire. Howie Long, when he did Broken Arrow with Travolta and Christian Slater, right? He got a lot of good notice. Oh, Harry Long's pretty cool. He has a good screen presence. He signs a 3-picture deal.
With Fox.
This being the first picture.
Yeah.
And then he never saw the other two. Like, they never optioned the other two, the second and third film for him. So his movie career sort of crashed and burned with this movie. The premise is interesting, but it's
Die Hard in a fire, a forest fire, right? Basically, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, he had a good screen presence, Howie Long. And he played the henchman in Broken Arrow. So, you know, somebody at the studio said, hey, you know, Howie Long could be the next big thing. It never really materialized, though.
That was in 1998. In 2000, a movie we both liked. Not a lot of fire sequences, but Dennis Quaid and Jim Caviezel in Frequency deals with the firefighter in that movie as well.
And I love that movie.
A mystery over a time travel movie that revolves around the 1969 Mets winning the World Series, too. Very good film, Chuck. And it's interesting how these two stars now, the careers they have currently, as opposed to what they had in 2000.
Yeah. I mean, Caviezel has his own sort of vacuum of success. And you're right. Dennis Quaid is doing a lot of Christian allegory movies now. You know, it's interesting because, I mean, we all age, but Dennis Quaid in his 50s looked great.
Yeah.
Getting plum roles.
Yeah,
he's a little bit up there now. He's starting to show his age a little bit more. But listen, he's a big name in pop culture, and I always enjoy anything he does.
He aged very similar to the way Harrison Ford aged on screen. Just very similar to be able to do those 7-year run on TV. I wasn't a huge fan of it. Watched every once in a while. Rescue Me with Dennis Leary.
No, I was a big fan. Listen, here's the interesting part about that show. Dennis Leary clearly played homage and love to firefighters, and I liked that show immensely. The one caveat about that show is Dennis Leary's character was not really likable. He was not a likable guy. He was a complete he was a screw up in many facets of his life. So I would say he was the least likable as the lead character on an ensemble show that had a lot of really good characters, very adult oriented. I would say hard R in terms of TV content. It was an FX show. But I liked all the characters. I liked that show. It was a big favorite. I watched every week. I liked it a lot.
That started in 2004. I might say Ladder 49 might be the last John Travolta headline, a major motion picture
Joaquin
in a theater's
Phoenix,
movie.
Yeah.
Joaquin Phoenix, right? Yeah. Would that be the benchmark for Travolta? Is it Ladder 49? I can't remember anything after that people went to the theaters to see him because he was headlining. This is a very popular flick among firefighters, Ladder 49 with Joaquin Phoenix and John Travolta. Good flick.
Yeah, I liked it. You might be right. You know, it's interesting. Is being rumored strongly that Travolta will have a part in Quentin Tarantino's next movie. So it's going to be interesting if Tarantino could reboot him two times in his life. One with Pulp Fiction, which opened the door for Travolta to get big paycheck, high quality movies. Can it be done again? Maybe not, but let's see. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Two movies that are similar to The Towering Inferno. One I would recommend is a Japanese film, The Tower, which is really good, but also basically the same kind of film was the 2018 Skyscraper flick with Dwayne The Rock Johnson, which tried to contain about seven different genres in one film.
Yeah.
Die Hard in a Building, then The Fire and Towering Inferno. I mean, it was so...
It almost feels as big as
forgotten.
His persona
yeah.
is. It almost feels forgotten, right?
I think rightfully so. We both enjoyed San Andreas because Dwayne Johnson was actually playing a much grounded character. Skyscrapers were very, very over the top,
and
it's okay to be over.
They got to give him a peg leg.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay to be over the top, but be tongue in cheek about it. It's over the top, but yet very, very serious. And to me, it was so implausible. It didn't help me enjoying the film at all. I couldn't
terrible,
get through.
It does have Neve Campbell's good as his wife. It does have some entertainment value, but instead of making it grounded, if they would have just went a grounded route and make it believable, like The Towering Inferno, it's The Towering Inferno on steroids. And, you know, instead of putting the fire out with water, you know, Dwayne Johnson's punching the fire. It's just too much.
I would recommend The Tower, though. It's really good. Japanese, you got to subtitle it, but it's very yeah. similar to that as well.
I would agree.
And I wanted to end. We got in On Fire, which is coming out this weekend. We're going to talk to Peter Facinelli
yes.
here in a second. That's part of the reason we're doing this. And the last firefight, well, Those Who Wish Me Dead, which also starred Angelina Jolie, came out a few years ago on streaming. But the last firefighter movie I wanted to bring up was maybe one of the best ones as well. And that's Only the Brave, Chuck, which stars Josh Brolin, a very powerful film based on a true story. Jeff Bridges gives one of his best performances of all time. This movie is very, very good, Chuck. Hard to watch because of the
harrowing.
Content.
It's hard to watch. It's hard to watch because it is, and in terms of its realism and the dangers of what these people do, this is a hardcore movie with a terrific cast. Jennifer Connelly's, I think
so
it's
good.
Awesome.
Miles Teller is fantastic. Miles Teller's fantastic in this film as well. It's one of those movies where it's hard. You can't call it rewatchable, right? Because you watch it once, you're like, it's so heart-tugging.
And I discovered it on Blu-ray. I did not see it in a movie theater. And when I watched it on Blu-ray, I was blown away how good this movie was. Very, very good movie.
Yeah, I saw it in theaters. I cried my eyes out. And it's just such a great film. So if you haven't seen Only the Brave, go check it out now. So that's our trip through fire, Chuck. Let's hear your interview with Peter Facinelli, and we'll come back and recap the show.
Writer, actor, producer. Primarily, most people would know him from the Twilight movies, also Nurse Jackie, one of the best ensemble shows, I think, of the 2000s. I love that show. Peter's currently promoting his new film, On Fire, which is a independent movie being released in movie theaters this weekend. In the film, Peter plays part of a family who has to escape a wildfire in Northern California. Peter, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me on. Thank you so much.
Okay. I just want to preface before I give you the floor. I got a chance to watch the trailer of this film a few weeks ago, and I was pleasantly surprised by the genre because I'll tell you a quick story. When I was a kid in 1972, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my parents took me to the Avalon Movie Theater, King's Highway, in the balcony, and we watched a Poseidon Adventure starring Gene Hackman and Ernest Borgnine, produced by the master of disaster, Irwin Allen. And that became my childhood Star Wars. I've watched that movie repeatedly. It has gone on to become my all-time favorite film. As a child, I could not wait to see disaster movies like The Towering Inferno in 1974, Earthquake in the same year. The genre itself, I don't know how familiar you are with it, but it was sort of revitalized in the 1990s when Stallone did Daylight, Tommy Lee Jones did Volcano, Tia Leone did Deep Impact. So I love this genre. And I got to tell you, Peter, I am very happy that this movie is being released theatrically. And I got a few questions for you. One, what about the project got you interested in wanting to do it? Because I do believe these type of films work very well when an actor such as yourself, who is identifiable as an everyday man, gets involved in character in this type of film, because I think the audience interest increases with an actor like yourself playing a part like this. So how did this project come about? How long was the shoot? I know you're listed as co-director, and we'll go into that as we speak, but how did this all play out?
Well, I received the script, and it was twofold. Look, I'm a fan, too, of family survival films, so that, to me, was already appealing. But then it had this very poignant storyline that had to do with wildfires, and it was, even back then, it was in the news. We had the big Australia fire. There was fires breaking out in other places. And Northern California had their fires, and every year it seemed like fires were happening. So I thought, you know, this story really is poignant. But like those films, you know, you have this journey that the family goes on, which is the core essential part of a family survival film. But unlike those films, which I really liked in this one, usually in those films, like, the dad is the hero and he's going to like lead everybody to safety. And in this one, you know, my character has his heroic moments, but he's just a dad trying to figure it out. You know, he's doing his best. And then my wife also has her heroic moments. And my son in it, who's played by Asher Angel, who's fantastic at it. He was in Shazam. He's like 19 or 20. He has his heroic moments. So it's really a movie about this family that's kind of growing together through this experience and is there for each other. And it also has this storyline of this 911 operator that's new on the job in a sleepy town, and all of a sudden she's thrown into ground zero and trying to do it the best she can, and she connects with this one family and tries to help them out. So it's an exciting movie. It keeps you on the edge of your seats. You're not going to fall asleep in this film or even want to get up to go to the bathroom. And then at the end of the film, we give tribute to firefighters, 911 operators. We actually dedicate the film to them. So I'm excited, because if people have a firefighter or a first responder in their families or a friend, buy them a ticket, go see it with them. This movie's dedicated to them, and I think they'd appreciate it.
Very cool. Again, we're talking to Peter Facinelli, whose new movie, On Fire, opens in theaters this weekend. Talk a little bit about the co-directing. Nick Lyon was listed as director. I read in some of your interviews that he got COVID during production, so he handed off the reins to you to finish up the film. I am very curious. Tell me about the editing room process. After you shoot the film, and by the way, how long was the shoot in general?
It's about 3 weeks. Shoot. I signed up as an actor. You know, Nick and I were working collaboratively. I think I really respect him as a filmmaker. He respected me as a filmmaker. I've directed two films before. And, you know, when we were going in to tackle the scenes, we were always sitting there going, well, what can we do to make this scene better? How can we have more payoffs, setups of payoffs? How can we put more themes in this? There's a lot of takeaways in this film that we put in there under the umbrella of the family survival film. So when he got COVID, you know, your captain's down, and you're like, what do you do? We're too small of a film to shut down, and we couldn't go back to court. So, you know, Nick looked at me and said, hey, here's the baton. I know you know what we're doing here. And then I'm just pulling double duty at that point. You know, I'm showing up a set as an actor, but also running the ship. I finished the film up, and we just took that collaboration into the editing room. You know, he did a cut. We gave notes. I went in, I brought my composer in from my last movie and worked with that. Then we did worked together on the CGI. It was, and we celebrated that collaborative, you know, work with a co-director credit.
Now tell us, because I watch a couple of your interviews. Tell us about the score of the film. How important the score is to setting the mood for the overall story.
Well, it's so important in a film like this because, you know, originally we had an early cut and it was just trying to be something it wasn't. It was action music all the way through, and it just didn't feel like I was connecting with the audience and the audience was connecting with the characters. So, you know, I brought in my composer and he really, you know, I said, listen, I don't want to hear any action music till the last 10 minutes. Slow the music down. Treat the fire like it's an alien invasion that's coming and growing. Give it a sound design. Give it a character of its own, because that fire is the antagonist of the movie, you know? It's the shark in Jaws is the fire, you know? So it's a slowing down the music and having this music that gives you the gears of the film, where to speed up, where to slow down. It really helped guide the story for us. And then there's moments where I was like, look, take the music out because we need moments of silence before it starts, this action starts up, you know, again. And I feel like he really nailed that. So the pacing is really, really strong in this film.
Very good. Now a question. Have you watched the final product with an audience?
Yes. And it's really
exciting. What was that like?
Because, you know, it's really exciting because at the end of the movie, I've had audiences give it a standing ovation. I've had audiences so excited at the end of the film because it leaves off with a message of hope. It leaves off with a message of rebirth. But you've just gone through this harrowing journey with this family. And there's not one person that's gotten up, you know, to go to the bathroom, including me. I watched the movie now. I had a screening. I had to pee, and I was like, no, I can't. I this is the good part. So
that's super,
I know,
cool.
If you go see the film, it'll be money well spent. If you have a firefighter or 911, you know, responder in the family or a friend, take them. You know, they'll appreciate it.
Very good. Well, you're doing a great job promoting it. I do have a question. And by the way, we're on the line with Peter Facinelli, who has his new movie On Fire in theaters this weekend. Just give me an idea, in your opinion, I'm very curious, your opinion of the industry in terms of getting films made, what gets made pre-COVID versus post-COVID. I have very strong opinions on this because I think the industry, and I would assume you would agree, has changed dramatically post-COVID. So you as a working actor, working in the business pre-COVID versus working as an actor post-COVID. Just give me your thoughts on that subject.
Yeah. You know, it's tough because the momentum was really shut down over COVID, I felt. And then it started to get right back on track. And then the strike happened. And I felt like we were just starting to get, you know, the theaters were starting to get back to where they needed to be. And then the strike happened and it kind of shut everything down again, which is one of the, you know, it was important to me to go and get the SAG interim agreement with these producers. The producers didn't have to sign it. They could have released it under the old agreement, but they stood by their actors. We're getting all the terms and conditions we're asking for under the agreement that these producers signed, which is something to celebrate. We're actually the first film going to theaters that under the new SAG interim agreement, which is a beautiful thing to celebrate.
That's
as
awesome.
Well. So I'm excited to be a pioneer in that and steer people back to theaters. You know, this is a great way to support actors that are on strike.
I 100% agree.
Supported by that. Yeah. By
100% agree. Well, Peter, I want to thank you for your time. Best of luck. I don't know you personally, but I'm proud of you. I'm really happy this movie will play theatrically. Again, it's called On Fire in theaters this weekend. Peter, thank you very much for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you.
That was Peter Facinelli. His new movie's On Fire. It's in theaters now. In theaters, most importantly, underline, Chuck, Peter Facinelli.
Excellent.
A real good job there. And I think next week we're going to have another special guest on the show. Who you got lined up?
Matthew Lillard from Scream and Shaggy of Scooby-Doo, talking about his new journey in life as an entrepreneur. Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, a lot of actors doing that kind of stuff now. And Matthew Lillard, the one scene I think of Matthew Lillard is freaking Scream when Skeet Ulrich keeps stabbing him. And I think you went a little too deep that time. Just some of that stuff. He stands out enough. And, you know, that really launched his career because he was able to do that kind of shtick in a lot of other movies, whether it be Summer Catcher.
It's a unique shtick, too. He's a unique actor, there's no doubt.
He is. It's good stuff. All right, Chuck, Movie Moments. We'll do it all over again next week.
Mike, to the audience, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Movie Moments with Chuck Curry and Mike Rags. Download and listen to an archive show or be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts to hear our new episode.
Podcasts by Federated Media.